Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Guy McPherson, and I'm going solo tonight. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. Sorry, but there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrazen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Background music for a couple of segments, including the next one, is provided by 17-year-old Rhiann Farrigan from Scotland. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. I'll mention two stories. My first story beyond the echo chamber comes from Michael Krieger at libertyblitzkrieg.com. It's from October 8th and is titled "Non-Official Cover, Respected German Journalist Blows Whistle on How the CIA Controls the Media." Here's the lead. Quote, "I was bribed by billionaires. I was bribed by the Americans to report not exactly the truth," end quote. That line is from Udo Ulfkati, former editor of one of Germany's main daily news publications. The story goes on to quote Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame at some length. Quote, "In 1953, Joseph Alsop, then one of America's leading syndicated columnists, went to the Philippines to cover an election. He did not go because he was asked to do so by his syndicate. He did not go because he was asked to do so by the newspapers that printed his column. He went at the request of the CIA. Alsop is one of more than 400 American journalists who in the past 25 years have secretly carried out assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency, according to documents on file at CIA headquarters," end quote. That's from a 25,000-word article published in Rolling Stone magazine in 1977, 37 years ago. The CIA clearly has been exerting an iron fist on the mainstream media since at least 1953, 64 years ago. If this piques your curiosity, peer into Operation Mockingbird. It's so much worse than you've been led to believe by the complicit mainstream media. As George Orwell pointed out, quote, "Journalism is printing what someone else does not want printed. Everything else is public relations," end quote. The mainstream media represent the public relations arm of the banksters we've allowed to take control of society. My second story beyond the mainstream comes from Desdemona Despair last Saturday, October 11th, with a headline article, "With Dry Taps and Toilets, California Drought Turns Desperate." A quote from the opening paragraphs. "After a nine-hour day working at a citrus packing plant, her body covered in a sheen of fruit wax and dust, there's nothing Angelica Gallegos wants more than a hot shower with steam to help clear her throat and lungs. But she has not had running water for more than 5 months, nor is there any tap water in her near future, because of a punishing and relentless drought in California. In the Gallegos household and more than 500 others in Tulare County, residents cannot flush a toilet, fill a drinking glass, wash dishes or clothes, or even rinse their hands without reaching for a bottle or bucket," end quote. The concluding paragraph quotes another member of the local community, quote, "You don't think of water as a privilege until you don't have it anymore," said Ms. Serrato, whose husband works in the nearby fields. "We were very proud of making a life here for ourselves, for raising children here. We never expected to live this way," end quote. Welcome to the future, Ms. Serrato. We'll all catch up, and sooner than most Americans can imagine. I suspect most of us will starve rather than dying from dehydration. Either way, nature bats last. This brings up the issue of inner peace. Personally, I would love to pursue inner peace. Really, I would. But instead, I'm reminded of a line from humorist Fran Lebowitz. Quote, there is no such thing as inner peace. There is only nervousness and death. End quote. Remember, she's a humorist, just like me. This week, I engage in conversation with Myrne Lorraine from Canada and Mike Farragon from Scotland. Myrne Lorraine is an unschooling mom and a novice permaculture gardener living in the small town of Paris, Ontario. She learned organic agriculture and animal husbandry on her grandparents' farm as a child. At the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook, she volunteers as an administrator in her spare time. She has a background in political science and women's studies from York University in Toronto. There she focused on anti-oppressive politics, disability studies, cyber theory, and anti-violence work. She's been a self-declared anarchist for 30 years. I'm pretty sure Mike Farragon is featured in the Guinness Book of World Records. Very few people in Scotland can claim to have coordinated as many campaigns on environmental and social justice issues as Mike. He lives in Edinburgh, Scotland, and is the founder of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. Mike has unique insight into the workings of NGOs and party politics. As a grassroots activist for 30 years, he received the Best Green Campaigner Award in the inaugural Scottish Green Awards of 2009 for his lifelong dedication and achievements. Some of the myriad organizations and campaigns for which Mike has worked include the Green Party, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, Scottish Democracy, Eradicating Ecocide, Anti-Fracking, and Occupy Edinburgh. Recently, Mike stood for election as a penguin named Professor Pongu, receiving worldwide media attention and trending on Twitter. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Myrne and Mike.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much, guys. Thanks for having us.
Let's start with anarchism. Many people confuse anarchy with chaos, but I suspect you have a more informed perspective. What's your perspective on anarchy? Myrne, we'll start with you and go to Mike after that.
Sure. Well, anarchism is a political theory, and it's been around for a few hundred years. It actually started around the same time that liberal democratic theories got started. And the goal of anarchism is to create a state of anarchy for all of us to live in. The idea being that we all are equal in political power, that we have equal access to the resources we need, and that we cooperate with one another to meet mutual objectives that we all agree on.
Great. What about you, Mike? Can you weigh in on the issue?
Yeah, I can weigh in. I think I'm probably coming into the category of one of those that people that are maybe confused by the meaning of anarchy. And I'm hesitant to be labelled as an anarchist as such. But since you mentioned it to me earlier, Guy, I think you probably hit the nail on the head. And I actually am an anarchist, so that's news to me. But I think Myrne has enlightened me here. But I think yes, you mentioned chaos. I think most people do see it as being chaos. But it's obviously chaos it's obviously not chaos, but it's obviously a system of organization without leaders, and that's how I see it, and I see it as being a system whereby you have small communities, manageable communities without leaders, but still with an organizational structure.
Excellent. Now, interestingly, for anarchists, you're both politically active, and Mike recently ran as the only penguin politician I've ever heard of. In so doing, he beat the Liberal Democrat in the race. Before you tell us about that, Mike, I'd like to play the first minute or so of the song promoting Professor Pongu, the penguin politician. Studio, can you give me the first few seconds of that?
Take on the Tories or Nats, or beat the Liberal Democrats, then don't go down the usual route. Get your yourself into a penguin suit. Professor Pongy,
he can walk the walk.
Professor Pongy,
don't need to talk the talk.
Professor Pongy,
he can walk the walk.
Professor Pongy,
don't need to talk the talk.
So, Mike Farragan, what's a penguin with anarchist tendencies doing running for office?
Anarchist tendencies, indeed. Well, it is a very long story, but it really started when the Scottish Government actually announced here in Scotland that they would be providing money for what they call the Climate Challenge Fund, which is money for community climate change projects around Scotland. I believe there are about 400 of them going at the moment. And this quite bizarrely came about by a strange inconsistency within the Scottish political system, whereby the two Green Party MSPs held the balance of power. Normally, if there had been 10 Green MSPs, they would have been ignored, MSP being a member of the Scottish Parliament, as opposed to an MP, which is a member of Parliament in Westminster. So they provided money, and I saw a loophole in Scottish legislation, which was the Parental Involvement Act of 2006, whereby it gave parents the opportunity to get involved in their children's education. And I thought, well, I want to get involved in my children's education. I want to get involved in my children's education on climate change, which they were not being taught at school. So I set up an eco group within my children's school, and my plan was to set up an eco group, a replicable plan for the whole of Scotland to teach children about climate change in all the schools due to this new legislation. So in order to engage the children, I actually received funding from the council, I received funding from the government, but in order to engage the primary school children, I had to have some kind of something to interest them, and I decided that I would become Professor Pongu, who, believe it or not, is the cousin of Pingu, who you may have heard of. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Pingu. I went dressed into the schools, into six different schools in my area, dressed as a penguin, and taught them about climate change. Needless to say, I didn't go into the high school or the secondary school dressed as a penguin. I went dressed as a sooty person, because otherwise I'm sure I would have had fish thrown at me or something of the like. But really, that's where the penguin came about. So I really wanted to build community capacity around the issue of climate change. And the project was being very successful. In fact, it was independently assessed as being one of the best climate change projects. The only thing about it was that I was a bit over-challenging, possibly, and I was topic of infinite economic growth kept cropping up in my presentations and in my reports back to the Climate Challenge Fund of the Scottish Government. And I think they thought I was a little bit too radical for them, and so they cut off my funding. So basically, once they cut off my funding, I decided, well, I won't swear here, but I guess you know how I may have felt, because it was my lifeline at the time. It was at a very personal level. I decided that I would stand for council as a penguin, and that's how it came about. I stood for council as a penguin, and because I was very well known in the community because of my presentations, not just to school children, but with scouts, with local communities, I actually did two presentations in church halls, which was fun, to congregations. I decided that I would try and get the £16,000 on offer from the council for councillors so that I could survive and bring money into my household. I stood as a penguin, and I'm actually quite glad now that I didn't get elected.
Yes, that's one of those acts that would be tough to follow. I'm reminded of a scene in a film with Robert Redford called The Candidate, and they ran an amazing campaign, and Robert Redford was elected to political office, and they're sitting around at the party afterwards, and he says, "Now what?" You know, the whole thing had been about the campaign. They hadn't really thought about what comes next.
Yeah.
Mike, you've done an excellent job indicating your perspective, on one of the topics I wanted to talk about, which is the links between political action, political parties, anarchism, and the Green Party. And so you've already given us a hint about an issue that motivated you to pursue political action. So, Myrn, if you don't mind, would you fill us in on your perspective regarding the links between anarchism, political parties, maybe including the Green Party, political action? What do we do in light of anarchism with respect to politics?
Okay, so my answer to that, like my answer to almost everything else, has changed radically since I came to understand first Collapse and then NTHE. I would have, 10 years ago, told you that party politics and traditional democratic politics could make some small difference in the lives of people living in democratic countries, and that there would sometimes be some reason to vote if there was a big difference between one party's policy and another party's policy. But that was before I understood that business as usual is driving us to extinction. So, as far as I know, there are no political parties anywhere. There certainly aren't any in Canada, which is where I live, that support the end of business as usual, what's sometimes called degrowth or décroissance. I think that's how you pronounce it in French. And the Green Party in Canada, as a matter of fact, is a particular problem because the leader of the Green Party came out a few months ago and she said that she would develop the tar sands slowly and carefully if she was elected.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So that's the Canadian Green Party, determined to slowly and carefully develop the tar sands.
So apparently it's better to be tortured slowly than all at once.
Yes, something along those lines. And so I haven't voted for a very long time in anything except for a municipal election, which is something that a lot of anarchists will say, you know, that's local government, and there's sort of an exemption for that sometimes among anarchists.
Right.
But at this point, do not vote is my advice to everybody. And if the best we can hope for at this point is something that like what happened in Cuba just before the revolution, which was they held a democratic election and 90% of people did not even bother to show up and vote. And that served as a mandate for the revolutionary parties to step in Cuba. But even, let's say we've got a revolution, which I would have also argued for 10 years ago or 5 years ago, and that takes mass movement. And we are out of time for that. We're out of time for that now.
Yeah, I certainly have to agree with that. Mike, do you have a additional perspective on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously agree with you that we're well out of time for that. We're about 50 years out of time for that, I'm afraid. So just to go back to what Bird said about don't vote. I tried to put this policy forward to the Scottish Green Party in 1990, and they're so wedded to the party political system, which is divisive and confrontational, obviously, that they couldn't see how getting 0.0001% of the vote was not beneficial in some way. So they didn't agree that we shouldn't run a campaign of not voting and a campaign of educating the public about how undemocratic our actual system of democracy is, which I believe democracy comes from the word democratica, which is Greek for rule by the people. And the Greens always talk about decisions being made at the local, the most local level, most appropriate local level. Now, should they achieve the level of that appropriateness? But they never actually put it into practice. They always talk about it, as other party politicians endlessly do, talking about giving power back to the people. But sadly, power is invested It's invested in politicians. They have their vested interests. Corporations control the politicians. Party politics is divisive. We can have a system which is more corrupt and more open to disempowering people than the system we have at present. And just to quote the Scottish Minister for Finance, he said that his main priority is the relentless pursuit of economic growth. Even in these times, they're talking about the relentless pursuit of economic growth using the North Sea oil. I'm afraid time is up, and it was up a long time ago, and we're not likely to see the politicians, the corporations, or any of the political parties change quickly.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing, Guy?
Please do.
I think at this point, any party that got into power, any revolutionary force that took power, it's what are they going to do? There's nothing that we can do to turn this around now.
Yeah.
Well, they could alleviate the suffering for those who are oppressed, for one thing. You know, in the time we have left, I would like to think we could act with compassion and kindness, even if you're a politician. And so taking steps that reduce the suffering of entire groups of people who are oppressed would be a nice beginning. We still have horrible racial unrest because of horrible racism in this country. And, you know, that's just one of dozens of examples of groups who are not treated well by society and by the system that the society has become.
Yes, that's true. And I agree with you that those are great objectives. But racism is a systemic fact. And to take racism apart is to take the entire system apart, to stop gender oppression or disability oppression or anything, any other kind of violence that this system perpetrates on a daily basis means to take apart the whole system, a system that's falling apart around us anyway.
Right, that's right. And so could we do more working within the system to try to make the outcome better? Probably so. But obviously it's going to take complete system change, meaning the system has to go away if we're to be completely rid of those systemic problems, those systemic biases and issues.
Yeah, and I think collapse means local action. Local action is where we could have the most impact as individuals. And I think states are going to go away pretty soon from this confluence of events coming down on us, energy descent and climate change and just this general biospheric collapse that's going on all around us. And states are just not going to be able to project power anymore. I guess that's why I focus my political efforts at the local level.
Well, I think that's great, and I think that's right to focus on the very local level, and that's what anarchism or tribalism, that's what they are, is focusing on the very local level. Mm-hmm. That's a nice segue into a question I have for Mike. Mike, let's talk briefly about the recent referendum in the UK. It turned out to be quite close. Although Scotland didn't break away as a separate political entity, but it's easy to imagine, as Myrne just pointed out, that soon we'll all be much more localized than we are right now. Can you comment on your view of the recent referendum in the UK?
Yeah, just to go back quickly to what Myrne said, I think we will become localized, not out of choice, but out of circumstance. I don't think there's any altruistic nature to party politics at all. I don't think they're going to devolve power so they can become more localized. Although I think it's commendable that people do take up local party politics, but in general, the people I see around me aren't particularly interested in doing that. To go back to your comment, yeah, we had a a pretty important referendum for me, because I've been involved in Scottish politics for a long time. I've been involved in the campaign for an independent Scottish Parliament for a long time, since 1990, really, when I gave up being a member of the Scottish Green Party and formed a vigil for a Scottish Parliament, which lasted for 5 years. And in the end, we got a Scottish Parliament, a devolved Scottish Parliament, but we didn't get all the powers that we wanted. The recent referendum was close, but, you know, 45% of the people actually voted yes, 55% of the people voted no. And this is a problem with our actual political system. It's majoritarianism, where the minority is disenfranchised. So we did have an option which was put forward called Devo Max, which a great majority of the Scottish people actually were in favour of, but some fine politicians down at Westminster decided that that could not be on the ballot paper, and they excluded it. Really, it was a divisive election, which is not good for the people of Scotland, although I'm very surprised how quickly we've got over the divisiveness of the campaign. But the campaign was really quite marked by the grassroots efforts of the Yes campaign as compared to the media manipulation and the Westminster manipulation of the No or Better Together campaign, and that's how it was marked. And really, we now have a sense of more togetherness here in Scotland at the grassroots, which we never had before. So we have not given up the fight by any means, and in fact, Westminster have promised us more powers, which they seem to be reneging on. But there is a special commission set up that is sadly balanced in the favour of Westminster, so any decision that is going to be made will probably mean that we won't get any more powers. If we do, it kind of goes back to the option which was excluded from the ballot paper, which was Devo Max. So we may be getting Devo Max anyway.
Right. I agree with you that there is no large-scale movement, not nearly enough people involved to generate degrowth or relocalization, that it's going to have to be done involuntarily, because I don't know, 35 people in the world who actually want it to happen. Maybe your perspective is different as a Canadian, Myrne. Can you touch on that a bit?
Well, actually, before Scotland had their referendum, we had two in Canada about Quebec separating. And precisely the same pattern was followed there. So the Canadian government set up the same kind of hard choice, refused to allow a way that would clearly have been preferred by the people of Quebec. A very similar situation to what he's talking about. So, obviously, part of the reason I'm an anarchist is because I recognize that human beings and human systems, institutions that get power, don't want to give it up. So they're going to fight tooth and nail to keep their power. The state is going to fight to keep its power. The kind of people who run for mainstream politics are people who believe that the state is a positive force for civilization. So, I agree with you, Guy, and I agree with what Mike's saying. We are going to localize, but we're going to localize because we've been forced to localize. I suppose my fear is that we're going to be living in failed states, which is not a state of anarchy as anarchists would have it, but rather a state of anarchy as people fear. Because when civilization collapses and falls apart, it doesn't do it peacefully.
No, that's exactly right. And many civilizations have gone by the wayside throughout human history, at least within the last few thousand years. And they all seem to follow that pattern of a lot of people starving and people seeking power as power eludes them and the violence ratcheting up, much as we're seeing now as industrial civilization teeters on the brink.
Yes.
This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Guy McPherson, and I'm joined by Canadian Myrne Lorraine and from Scotland.
In fact, Guy, from Scotland by Mike Ferrigan from Edinburgh. You call it Edinburgh, which is an irritation to us, yeah?
You, Myrne, and Mike serve as administrators of the most gentle, compassionate group I've seen on the Internet. How do you make that work?
Sorry, the NTHE group you're talking about?
The support group.
Yeah. Could you repeat that? How did it work? Well, I think that's your question. I don't know if I like to quote names of other particular groups, but there's a certain group which talks about facts about global warming. Some people may already have latched on to what I'm talking about, but they tend to be facts of yesterday, and they tend to be very conservative, lowest denominator facts of many countries and corporations and governments getting together after years of peer review, and they tend to be not based on observational or current evidence whatsoever. And I was getting frustrated joining that group and leaving it because I was challenging their stance on various issues, especially the nuclear stance of the admins on said group, which I have not mentioned, but I've made it obvious which group it is. So I decided there was no haven. There was absolutely no haven for anybody who had come to the conclusion that of near-term human extinction. I couldn't find one anywhere. I could find various doom groups, but I couldn't find any place specifically about near-term human extinction. So I decided to form one, but all I can say is that since the moment I formed it, it has gone from strength to strength, and it's become most of the wonderful, one of the best Facebook groups I've ever been involved in. I've been involved in a lot of Facebook groups, and considering the subject matter, I think we've done extremely well. I'm sure Myrne would like to come in on that as well.
Yeah, I was just, actually I posted a comment this morning when I was, just because it was in my mind, because I knew we were going to be talking about this on the show today. And I just was thinking about how very grateful I am to every member in that group, because I needed a safe haven. I needed a place that was emotionally safe for me to go and process all this information and come to terms with it, a place to do my grieving with other people. And like everybody else who believes in NTHE, who's come to this conclusion, there's a real shortage of people in my real life that I can talk to about that. So, or there's a shortage of how much they can take of me rambling on about it. So when I found Mike's group, I couldn't believe my luck. I just couldn't believe how nice people were. I couldn't believe how open people could be about their feelings and how people would just jump in when somebody was in trouble and try and help. And so when Mike asked me to be an admin, I really wanted to do that because I wanted to be of service. I wanted to help that group to continue.
Well, you bring up an important point. It's a haven. You both mentioned it as a haven, a place where you can express your thoughts and your feelings that might not be welcome in other groups. This is not a solution-oriented group.
No.
Mike, when you set it up, were you thinking about that? I mean, go into a little bit on the process of what you were thinking when you set this thing up, other than you didn't want it to be like the other groups that are sort of known for lashing out somewhat negatively.
Well, yes, Guy. I mean, there are quite simply no solutions to near-term human extinction. The observational evidence points to that, and even the peer-reviewed evidence, the correct evidence points to there are no solutions to this, including nuclear power and including renewable energy. Our biosphere, our habitat are almost completely destroyed, and the oceans are acidifying, and the climate is warmer than ever. We've just had the warmest September ever. So the basis of the group is that there's no hopium, as we call it, on the group. The hopium is not really allowed. We will give a little bit of leeway occasionally when somebody comes up with a little bit of hopium, but we will remind them that it is not a solution-based group and there are no solutions. Sadly, It's not something that I want. I would rather it not be the case, but sadly, no solutions to our present predicament. It's called near, and obviously there are interpretations of what near is, and we have anything from tomorrow until after 2100. Our members vary as to what the word near means, but most of the people, I'd say about three quarters of the people, believe that near means before 2050.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't think you'd have many people argue that that's near. And that's well supported by Tim Garrett's work. His signature paper was published in Climatic Change in November 2009, but it was written more than 7 years ago. And he pointed out in that paper that civilization is a heat engine, that only collapse of civilization will prevent runaway greenhouse. Well, that was written, that analysis was done, was completed and submitted more than 7 years ago. And of course we know that if civilization stops tomorrow or next week or next year, then what happens is we have catastrophic meltdown of the world's nuclear power plants, mm-hmm. because it takes a lot more time than that to safely decommission them. So, yes, I think it is completely appropriate to seek support, and of course we can quibble over what near means, but I don't think anybody would argue that extinction of our species within the next 100 years is a long time. And so I think quibbling about the nearness, quibbling about the date, is a little ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
Can I say something about one piece of hopium that I have left?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's related to the group. And this is the hope that by having this group, while the internet's still up, while we can still speak to one another from our diverse locations around the globe, we can process some of our feelings about this. We can become calmer and more accepting about this. So when everything goes dark, we will have more, I don't know what the right word is, energy, peace inside ourselves to be able to help other people. Because I'm expecting a lot of scapegoating going on, and I'm expecting a lot of violence going on. And I would like to think that our members being better prepared will not be in the same state of panic that other people might be.
Yeah, you want to comment, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. This is the supportive nature of the group is what is all important about the group. It certainly helped me in speaking to other members of the group on Skype, in PMing, in messages on the group. It certainly helped me to go through anger, to go through various stages of grief and come to terms with what is going to happen. Who knows how near, but I believe it is all going to break down very nastily into violence and into, as you mentioned, the nuclear power stations. I mean, we've been blessed with missiles on the Clyde here, which is very near to us, which we wouldn't have been blessed with had we become independent, because we'd have got rid of them. But they have 190 warheads on them, and that is insignificant compared with the thousands of warheads that America has. So it's completely insignificant, but it's very significant for the people that live on the Clyde if there should be accidents. So, I got the subject slightly there, but you mentioned nuclear power stations. There's 450 nearly nuclear power stations in the world. You talked about the decommissioning of them. It takes absolutely years. What's going to happen? You just have to look at one nuclear power station, the problems that Fukushima is causing. So, yeah, the group is needed. The group is needed big time. I would like to see the group expanding, in fact, to other countries with other translations of the group, and even believe it or not, getting funding and setting up real support groups all around the world where people can go to and get real on-the-ground support. I think that's just a little bit of a dream of mine, I'm afraid, but I'd love to see that actually happen, and I'd love to see people even get together in their locations, because I don't really have anybody I can really speak to here in Edinburgh about it. I don't have that local group, but I think that is the way to go forward. We need to actually speak to each other as groups, as communities, about this issue. I'd love to see the group actually expand that way, and I'd like to put a call out to anybody who's out there and who'd like to at first help on the near-term human extinction support group on Facebook. If they'd like to help with an admin, if they'd help, like to help with outreach, there's a huge amount of work that we can do to actually outreach to other countries, because at the moment I think most of the members are Americans or Canadians. So there's a lot of other countries out there that are actually suffering the direct consequences of climate change, and we're all quite privileged to be sitting here. Hello? I'm not sure what that was. We're all quite privileged here to be sitting behind our phones or our laptops or whatever and talk about it, but there are people that are really suffering, and I like to think that somehow we'd be able to get out there and support them.
Yes, you both bring up an important point. You keep saying the same word over and over again, and the word is service. You keep looking for ways to provide service to other human beings, presumably in small groups. Now, Mike, you mentioned without mentioning the Global Warming Fact of the Day group on Facebook, comprised almost completely of middle-aged white men, and I don't hear the word service come up from most middle-aged white men. Man, and certainly not from that group. Why is that? Myrn, perhaps you can give us your female perspective.
Well, I can give you my women's studies perspective as an official feminist perspective.
Yes, please.
Okay, so according to my education, the white men, and especially middle class or wealthier white men in our culture, right, which is the, I would call the Anglo-American culture, but you can call it other things, and in others, have been given to believe that their every utterance is a service to everybody else. That's the way the system's set up. It's set up.
Wait. As a middle-aged heterosexual white man,
yes,
that's not the way it's supposed to work. I've been misled this whole time.
I think you've been misled, Guy.
Go ahead.
It's okay. So the system is set up to encourage some people to speak, to encourage some people to believe that, of course, anything they have to say is going to be a valuable contribution to society. It's encouraged to convince women, people of color, people with disabilities, people who are poor, et cetera, the list can go on, to believe that they have nothing to say, nothing to offer, and instead we should all be very grateful to the middle-class white men who are running the show and submit to their sort of natural authority. And it's never stated that blatantly anymore, not for some time, or rarely stated that blatantly anymore. But that's still the system.
Right. The privilege is unspoken.
Yes.
But it's there.
It has to be unspoken. It has to hide. It has to pretend that it's not there.
Because if we bring it out in the open, then it's obvious that it's a select group that is being selected for and favored and privileged and so on.
Yes. And this is, of course, anti-democratic, very obviously to everybody. And has been the tension among, you know, in democratic theory from the very, very beginnings of it.
Well, I don't think it's all that obvious to white men who are benefiting from the system.
No, of course not. And in fact, it takes us, speaking as a white woman, right, who was raised in a fairly middle-class home, although my father was a caretaker, my mother was an RN, it wasn't obvious to me that whiteness was a privilege. It wasn't obvious to me that being in the middle class was a privilege until I started to grow up, you know, and started to look around the world and started to do some reading. It's not self-evident from your position of privilege that you're privileged. It takes work to figure it out.
Right. Did you want to comment on that, Mr. Privileged White Guy from Scotland?
Well, yeah. I suppose I am a privileged white guy from Scotland. The amount of food banks that are being set up here at the moment are increasing radically, exponentially, which is quite scary. And I'm not quite at that condition yet. I would just before that, like before I forget it, to mention another group, which is a kind of adjunct to the near term human extinction support group, which is it's called Whistling in the Dark, because you'll imagine that we get all sorts of controversial subjects from Ebola to population to nuclear power to all sorts of subjects you could imagine coming up on the group that we have to manage. One of the subjects is population and in parenting. And there's a special group for those parents that in any way feel threatened or would like to talk to other parents, and it's called Whistling in the Dark. So you can just go to Facebook and find Whistling in the Dark, and you'll find a bunch of parents there with a bunch of kids that all support each other. And it's a beautiful group, so I'd just like to mention that group. But yeah, I totally agree with Myrna about white male privilege and white male vested interest and white male supremacy and about the lack of women in politics. If women had had more power, if we'd had more matriarchal societies, then I think things might have been a little tad different. And if we'd gone off from this belief in this kind of... this belief in truth as an absolute, as opposed to potentially good, which is maybe more prevalent in the kind of Buddhist philosophies and the like, or the Eastern philosophies. If we had concentrated more on good in the past, then we might not be in this situation at the moment. That might seem a bit of an anathema to a scientist like yourself, Guy, but I just do believe that we've gone down the path of logic far too much, and we should have concentrated more on good and love amongst each other, and we might have not have got into this near-term human extinction predicament. Mm-hmm. This is I'm talking about a long time ago. This need to happen,
right? Yes. Like, given the 40-year lag between cause and effect with respect to carbon dioxide and heating, well over 40 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, but the book that comes to mind for me, which took me along that line, was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I don't know if you've ever read that book, Guy.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Well, that kind of had a big effect on my life, written by Robert Persig, and it kind of suggested, you know, you talk about two cerebral hemispheres and different ways of perceiving the world. I think if we perceive the world with a sense of good and love, then and instead of this endless pursuit for truth and scientific advancement and technological advancement and solution-based technology, then I think we may have had a chance of going in a different direction. But sadly, that's a dream now which has passed. And I'm afraid we're just going to have to put up with the consequences of an endless seeking for truth.
Yes, I agree. Myrne, you mentioned in a conversation before we went online something about spirituality and passion for rationality and great philosophers. Did you want to put that thought into a statement or a question?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So I was on a spiritual path, I've been a spiritual seeker since I was in my 20s. So I think it was really great that I did that before I came to confront collapse and NTHE, and that was helpful for me. Now, that path was made difficult for me because I have a rationality bias. I need things to be rational. I need them to not contradict scientific evidence before I can believe in them. I need to somehow reconcile that. So that's my history, and that's sort of where this question is arising. Now, I've noticed that you refer very often to philosophers. And I wondered if you had, and I've also heard you, you know, out and out say you don't really have a spiritual bent. And so I wondered if the philosophers, and if so, how those philosophers and your reading of literature maybe too, has helped you come to terms with what we're going through here.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't that long ago that philosophy and science were one and the same. In fact, I would argue that they remained joined at the hip, at least, until the creation of the National Science Foundation in the United States, which pretty much was the final nail in the coffin in terms of separating philosophy from science. And now universities have become so siloed, so fragmented, that it's difficult for me to imagine the two of them being stated in the same sentence, except as antagonistic towards each other.
Yeah.
But my reading of the ancients, and here I'm talking about Socrates onward, roughly, indicates that rationality, that science, that philosophy and science are one and the same, and developing a personal philosophy, in my case rooted in reason, is completely consistent with what the ancients would call a spiritual worldview.
Mm-hmm.
The spirit from its root just means the wind, and the ancients, most notably Aristotle and Hippocrates, wrote a lot about nature and the natural world and our relation to the natural world. And so I don't think they're really that far apart.
Nicely said.
So I'd like to wrap now. If each of you would like to give me a 30-second bit on where we go from here, where you go from here, where the near-term human extinction support group goes from here, something like that. Why don't we start with you, Myrn?
Sure. I am going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm practicing permaculture. I plant whatever I can plant. I plant for bees. I plant for wildlife. I don't just plant for my family. And that gives me a sense of satisfaction. It's what you say, Guy. What is that thing about doing? You say it just slipped out of my mind. You know,
if you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then do.
Exactly. So that's one of the things on my list of doing. And another thing is to, while the net's still up, to do service over at Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. Because,
Thank you.
I said, you're welcome.
Thank you, Mike. What do you have for us?
Well, I've got another quote of yours, Guy, which is action is the antidote to despair, and which I quite like. And I don't think it's necessarily action within NGOs or within political parties. It's action within your own spiritual self, with living for the now and coming to terms with what lies ahead of us. And I will be continuing to moderate the near-term human extinction support group. Now I'll be continuing to try and develop my own spirituality to come to terms with it and get more involved in meditation and come to terms with family members, for instance, children, grandchildren and the like, and but also to try to come to terms with how we indeed relate to society in terms of near-term human extinction. But it's very, very difficult to get through to people that are not in this kind of bubble that we all exist in. So just as a last point, I'd just like to once again thank all the members of our group, for the tone of the group especially, for keeping respect for each other, and long may that continue, and long may we continue to support each other. And I'd like to thank all the admins, all the past admins that have helped run the group, because there is a turnover of admins, and I would really, really like people who do have a little bit of time on their hands to get involved, because I assure you, it is not an easy job. And we all spend many, many hours a day managing that group. So if there's anybody out there that wants to help, just get in touch with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike Farragan and Myrn Lorraine, for joining me on Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Beth. This week's
climate change update includes six items. Item one, in the category of scientists being muzzled by governments, federal scientists in Canada who keep a close eye on the Arctic ice would like to routinely brief Canadians about extraordinary events unfolding in the north. But newly released federal documents show the Harper government has been thwarting their efforts. Item two, Gavin Schmidt, who replaced James Hansen this summer as head of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, is working hard to convince people abrupt climate change is a myth, even though it's underway. Schmidt disparaged Drs. Natalia Shikova and Igor Samelatov, the world's leading authorities on the subject of methane release from the Arctic Ocean. Specifically, the Russian scientists were excluded from presenting their research at the Royal Society, and Schmidt attempted to discredit their observational studies with a series of unprofessional tweets on Twitter. Schmidt is a modeler who incorrectly believes empirical observations ought to be fit into the models instead of creating models derived from reality. Item 3, research published in the September 29th issue of Nature Communications, illustrates that the Greenland ice sheet is profoundly sensitive to melting. Surface meltwater draining through cracks in an ice sheet can warm the sheet from the inside, softening the ice and letting it flow faster. Item 4, the hits keep coming. In the same issue of the same journal comes a 39th irreversible self-reinforcing feedback loop, or positive feedback. Quote, during the last glacial termination, the upwelling strength of the southern polar limb of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation varied, changing the ventilation and stratification of the high-latitude southern ocean. During the same period, at least two phases of abrupt global sea level rise, meltwater pulses, took place, end quote. In other words, when the ocean around Antarctica became more stratified or layered, warm water at depth melted the ice sheet faster than when the ocean was less stratified. Item 5, ocean warming has been profoundly underestimated since the 1970s, according to a paper published in the online version of Nature Climate Change on October 5th. Specifically, the upper 2,300 feet of the southern hemisphere's oceans may have warmed twice as quickly after 1970 than had previously been thought. Finally, item 6, because of the deforestation of tropical forests in Brazil, significantly more carbon has been lost than was previously assumed. In fact, forest fragmentation results in up to a fifth more carbon dioxide being emitted by the vegetation. These results come from the October 7th issue of Nature Communications. The bottom line remains the same as before. Climate change and its impacts are happening more quickly than had been previously thought. You can find these updates and all future ones at GuyMcPherson.com. Each week, I close out with a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. The doomer for this week is Methane Mike Scholdes, who posted the following comment last week on the Facebook page for the Methane Clathrate Gun Time Bomb Group. Mike was responding to one of the many recent articles pointing out that a methane hotspot in the southwestern United States is bigger than expected. He writes, quote, wow, things are worse than previously thought. I see a constant theme emerging here. Let's call it the law of doom. Reality of the atmosphere is usually more messed up than we can imagine or measure, end quote. Bottom line remains the same. Environmental destruction is happening more quickly than had been previously thought. That wraps it up for this week. Please tune in next week when I will interview whistleblower and former high-ranking member of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, Ray McGovern. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bath Blast, and the Progressive Radio Network. Join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bath Blast on PRN.FM. Beginning in a week, I'll be hosted by Kevin Hester in New Zealand for a couple weeks. We'll start in Auckland and proceed to various other locales on both islands. You can keep abreast of that and future speaking tours on my blog and also on Facebook. Finally, if you're finding yourself in need of dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook and join the conversation that we've talked about this evening. There are plenty of people going through a similar emotional roller coaster who help provide some personal insight into these monumental issues. Last Thursday night in that group, Linda Poulter had this to say. Report from Long Island. Talking to my parents as friends, I say that I am surprised about how little concern I see about global warming, considering Long Island is, you know, an island at sea level. Friend says, I know. And when I say that, people look at me like I'm crazy, so I think this guy's got it. Then he says, but it's our grandkids' problem. We don't have to worry about it. Wow. Can you say entitlement? How about empathy? Most people claim to care about their grandchildren. This character, not so much. See you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, be sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrozen and Rianne Farragon for the music. Take it away, Afrozen, with Nature Bats Last.